On this episode of Still Loading, Gaming in Tokyo. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have a special guest for you all. So normally, I don't interview a lot of other podcasters, and it's not because all my podcasting friends out there, you know I love you all, but my show doesn't necessarily lend itself to interviewing other podcasters. I try to keep it to things about people in the game industry, but today I have another podcaster on because the topic of their show is incredibly unique to me, and it's also something that I don't see a lot of other podcasters covering. A lot of podcasters in the gaming sphere usually cover gaming news, or they cover, what I do, which is more retrospectives. Well, actually, mine's kind of like a grab bag of stuff, but you either retrospectives on games, modern or old, or more essays on games. But who I have on today, his name is Mono from the podcast Tokyo Game Life, and it's kind of like a slice of life podcast for a gamer in Tokyo that covers a variety of things. It does do some gaming news, but it's very Japanese-centered gaming news, which I find really enjoyable. So with that long, outrageously long intro out of the way, Mono, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for coming on, man. I've been looking forward to this all week. I was actually talking to a coworker earlier today who he was in the military back in like the 70s or 80s, and he was stationed in Japan. And when I told him that I was having someone from Japan on, or someone who lives in Japan on, he was so excited. So he unfortunately has some issues where he doesn't have easy access to internet. So I kid you not, I might just burn this episode to a CD so he can listen to it easily.
That's great. Yeah.
So let's kind of dive right into this. So you are not originally from Japan. You are from the States. So I wanted to ask you, what made you move to Japan in the first place?
Well, growing up, I always had an interest in Japan, and I think a lot of it did start with video games. I was a child of the 90s, so at this time, every video game is pretty much from Japan, even though you really don't think of it as a kid that, oh, you're playing Japanese games by Japanese developers. You do start to notice, okay, all these names sound Japanese, and in the credits, everybody has a Japanese name, and Nintendo, Sega, Sony, these are all from Japan. So it started to link in my brain, okay, video games are from Japan, and that's the major link between those two. There's only video games that come from Japan. And also at this time, as I started to get a bit older, my father visited Japan and he told me about his adventures over there. And I started to get a bit more interested in more of the cultural aspects of Japan, not just kind of nerd or otaku culture, which is great, but also sort of history and culture and traditions and language. So in college, I did study Japanese a little bit, but really I didn't get past basic. But I still had a great passion for Japan. I really loved Japanese movies, especially classic movies from like the 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Kurosawa and Ozu and Mizoguchi, those types of people. And at the time I thought, you know, everything I read about Japan, it just seems fascinating, whether it's like their history or like very specific cultural elements like tea ceremony or origami or technology. Just everything I read seemed interesting. And in college, I also had quite a few Japanese friends. So it was a great cultural exchange between sharing American culture with them and also them telling me about their experiences in Japan. So it kind of went gradual. It really did kind of start with video games a little bit as a child, mm-hmm. but then it grew into something much, much bigger and something much more serious. And eventually, I decided to make the move to Japan. I wasn't very satisfied with my life at the time. So I thought, well, why not just, quit my job and then move to Japan. That seems like a very logical step, even though, you know, it's a very risky one. But I took that leap, and yeah, I'm glad I did. And now I'm here hosting a podcast about video games in Japan. So it all worked out.
How long have you been in Japan now?
I'm about almost 5 years.
Almost 5 years. Yes. Okay.
So it was, if you want to know the exact date, July 1st, 2017, 2017. So right about the time the Switch was still brand new at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I pretty much break down my life by console generations. Like, okay, the GameCube era, I was doing this. In the Wii era, I was doing this. So Switch era is basically my life in Japan.
That's an interesting way to look at it. And what a perfect time to get over there too, during one of Nintendo's most exciting eras in recent memory.
Exactly.
So that's really cool. So this is kind of a question I was mulling about, but I wasn't sure if I would find a segue into it. And I guess this kind of works. What is the difference you've noticed between kind of like otaku culture in the US, like almost like the US's vision of what Japan is, like within the fan community, you know, like the vision that, you know, maybe people at anime conventions and gaming conventions see of Japan versus the actuality of living there?
Well, Japan is a country. It is, although it is, you know, very amazing at times, especially if you are interested in Japanese culture, it is still a country. You know, it has roads, it has sidewalks, people wake up, they go to work. The daily life, it's not particularly massively different from, I think, what a lot of Americans experience. Mm-hmm. Of course, people have the same problems in America and Japan, you know, regarding money or regarding, you know, satisfaction in life, or, oh, I want to buy something and it's sold out. You know, every small problem, every big problem that a lot of Americans have, many Japanese people also have it. I think a lot of maybe otaku people, maybe they have the idea that Japan is a wonderland or like fantasy or like Disneyland.
Yeah, that's the vibe I've always gotten from fan. Like almost like it's glorified. So I was curious, like what that. Yeah, sorry, I cut you off. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying about like the American otaku feels very much like they glorify their vision of Japan.
Yes, and I think there are definitely things to glorify. Like Japan, of course, is a very beautiful country, and it's filled with, you know, culture and amazing things to do, especially Tokyo. You know, I'll still say Tokyo is like probably the best place on the planet, at least I've lived. That's the place I only want to live here. I don't want to live in a different place. So it is like an amazing place. And I would say that it is kind of like a fantasy land in some ways. For example, if you go to a train station, you'll see ads for like anime. You'll see ads for games that you probably won't see elsewhere. You'll see people like on their bags, they have, you know, a lot of anime goods or gaming merch. And, you know, you'll like part of my show is like covering events and covering places that are very game centric. And so these places do exist. So I would say it is somewhat normal most of the time, but there are pockets of, you know, geeky wonderlands every now and then.
Yeah.
So if you know where to look, you can really, you know, embrace this type of subculture in Japan.
That is really interesting. That actually perfectly segues into one of my next questions. Is you cover a variety of topics on your show. You know, you talk about Nintendo news because that's one of your personal favorite subjects of gaming. But what I love is when you cover kind of like the gaming specific events. I was talking to you off mic about like the Street Fighter 35th anniversary art exhibit that you went to, or I guess this was last week's episode where you kind of went to like that racing like mini arcade type of thing where it's like there's three computer monitors. I forget exactly what it was, like a DDR
Akiba is the name.
DDR Akiba. Okay.
Nothing to do with Dance Dance Revolution despite the name.
It was very confusing. I was like, yes. Oh, this is a DDR. When I downloaded the episode, I was like, oh, this is a DDR thing. And then you're talking about racing. I'm like, oh, it's not anywhere near that. Okay then. So how do you kind of find these things? Like, is it something that you have to actively keep an eye out for, or is it something that's easy to come across?
Well, one of the main features of my podcast is, I call it the feature, where I basically highlight a place or some sort of cultural element in, especially Tokyo, some sort of gaming cultural element in Tokyo. So many of these are places to visit like you mentioned before, the Street Fighter 35th anniversary exhibit. They had it in Shibuya, where they had art from a lot of the famous Street Fighter artists like Bingus and Kino Nishimura and those types of like titans of gaming character art. And that's like a limited time event, but there's also more permanent establishments like unique arcades like DDR Akiba, which is they advertise it as a racing sim arcade. So one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to start the podcast is to highlight these places and highlight these events, because they happen quite frequently, especially in Tokyo. Like I mentioned before, you know, Tokyo is a normal place most of the time, but hidden in the back alleys, hidden in, you know, a very nondescript building, you can find some of these amazing events, some of these amazing life experiences. And the way I find them, well, I would consider myself, you know, sort of an active and adventurous person, even though I'm, of course, a big gamer. You know, I don't just sit in my room and playing games all day. Sometimes I do, but, you know, not every day. Since I live in Japan.
That's not what gamers do. No, go on. Sorry.
I live in Japan, so I try to, you know, go out as much as possible, experience Tokyo, experience new things. And so sometimes I come up on them. Surely I come up to them just by happenstance. For example, my first feature was on the Mikado Game Center, which is a retro arcade. And they have like dozens of retro game cabs, like authentic game cabs, like the Space Harrier, but you're sitting in the seat. Also virtual on with like the two players and with the dual joysticks. And the way I found this was just purely by accident, because I used to study Japanese, or I took a Japanese class in Takata Nobaba, which is an area of Tokyo. And the class was on Saturday morning. And, you know, after Saturday morning, I'll have lunch. And then I'm thinking, well, you know, I have a little bit of time to kill and I've been studying all morning. So what's something I can do? So just on Google Maps, I just searched for like gameu, which is just game in Japanese.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like a couple of arcades would pop up. And then I noticed one that looked a bit, you know, different, because we do have a lot of chain arcades in Japan, like Taito Game Station. And well, not Sega anymore. Now it's
Ego. Rest in peace.
Yes, rest in peace. But these are chain arcades, and if you go to one, you've kind of been to all of them. But this one kind of stood out because it wasn't a chain, and it had quite a bit of reviews. So I went in there, and then as soon as I entered, it was just a lot of noise. But then on my left is like Afterburner, on my right is Outrun, and in the back is like Aliens versus Predator, the arcade cab, and like an Astro City cab. So I thought, where am I? It's kind of amazing. I just suddenly found this, you know, amazing place. And Tokyo is filled with these sorts of places. And another way I follow or I discover these places is through Twitter. I follow a lot of Japanese people on Twitter. And so just kind of by pure luck, I'll find like, the Street Fighter exhibit was somebody maybe retweeted it. And then I noticed it. And then, I'll definitely check that out. And also, I always say this, but in Tokyo, you can pretty much do anything. If you have some sort of hobby, or if you are in some sort of subculture, no matter what it is, Tokyo has a place for you. If you're into rock climbing, Tokyo has rock climbing places. If you're into tea ceremony, there are places to study tea ceremony, places to experience tea ceremony. If you're into like wrestling, there's an entire like street dedicated to like wrestling goods and wrestling merchandise. So no matter what you're into, you can do it in Tokyo. So that's kind of how I found my most recent feature about DDR Akiba, because I wanted to do something about the Mario Kart 8 DLC, and also F-Zero X came to Nintendo Switch Online. So I thought, well, those are two racing games. So let's try to make it a racing themed episode. Surely there must be some sort of racing arcade in Tokyo. I mean, that's kind of a ridiculous thing to think about in most places. Like, of course, this place doesn't have some sort of VR racing arcade. I don't know if that's in like Detroit or even in other places in Japan, like Kyoto or Sapporo. But I'm like, I'm in Tokyo. Surely there must be some sort of racing arcade. Surely there must be some sort of VR racing experience. And sure enough, I Googled and then I found DDR Akiba, and I got my feature for the next episode planned out. So it really is a mix of like circumstance exploring and also kind of being connected into the Japanese Twitter sphere.
Okay. Okay. That's really cool. I like your selection of choices. In fact, I just listened to your feature was not on a place that you went, but you were talking, you mentioned before you'd like to have the feature be something Japanese specific. And I listened to the one that you did with the Nintendo magazine. Why am I blanking on the name? I just listened to it today.
Nintendo Dream.
Yes. I actually, while I was listening to it, I was looking up, can I ship this to the US? You can't, not easily at least, or at least not directly from them that I saw. But the topics that you choose on the podcast are really interesting. So out of all those events that you've gone to, what have been some of your favorites so far, whether it's been events that you've gone to for the podcast or maybe even prior to starting the podcast?
One event that really stands out and that I did cover on the podcast is Pokemon Wonder. So Pokemon Wonder it's hard to explain. They advertise it as a real life Pokemon adventure, and it really is kind of that. But more, that's sort of a vague explanation, but it is kind of like an outdoor escape game themed around Pokemon. And this launched maybe, I think, last summer, so summer 2021. So many people overseas, unfortunately, have not been able to experience it. And even if tourists did come, I think a lot of people would miss it. Yomiuri Land is kind of like a touristy area. It's a theme park, just a Japanese theme park. And it's from the 60s, so it's been around quite a while. But compared to like Tokyo Disneyland or Tokyo Disney Sea, I think a lot of people skip it. And it is like a very like old amusement park. It's not super impressive, but Pokemon Wonder is really amazing, especially if you are a Pokemon fan. I think it really captures what it is to be in a Pokemon world, what it is to be like if you were living in like Kanto or living in Johto and searching for Pokemon. It perfectly encapsulates this experience. I can explain it a little bit. I explain it, of course, in rich detail in my podcast, but basically you go there and you enter a building that looks like it's ripped from a Pokemon game, and they give you a kind of a list of Pokemon you're going to find along with like a digital camera and also like a pouch and things like this. And then you really go into nature. You go into the first area is kind of like this big field. And it rained the day before, so it was really muddy. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to find Pokemon in the area based on these clues they give you. And so it's really fun because you are stomping through the mud searching for Pokemon. So it really feels like, oh, this is like just directly straight out of the game. And the Pokemon that you find, sadly, they are not real Pokemon, but they are kind of like real approximations. Like, for example,
it's not licensed. It's what you're saying.
Well, it is licensed, actually.
It is licensed. Yeah, it is an official. They don't use real Pokemon.
Because Pokemon don't exist, so you have to.
I thought you meant like they instead of like Pikachu, it would be like Keepachu or something, like it was like knockoffs. Okay, never mind. I get what you're saying.
It is an officially licensed event, and so you are finding like the Pokemon, but you're finding, for example, Roggenrola, which is like a rock type Pokemon. You're trying to find him, and then you open it, and it's a big rock shaped like Roggenrola. And a Diglett is kind of like, I'm not sure what it's made out of, but almost kind of like hay. It's like a thatched hay kind of Diglett statue in the ground. And there's some other ones that like Gengar is kind of just like a light, kind of like a black light pattern of Gengar. But that's also part of the fun, because even though you might know what Pokemon you're looking for, you don't know how it's portrayed. It might be like a statue, or it might be like a pattern displayed on, for example, on bamboo. One of the most amazing ones is you're in a bamboo forest and each bamboo stalk has part of a pattern. And if you stand in a specific spot, you can see all the pattern congeal together to make the Pokemon.
That's clever.
Yes. So it's really amazing. Like it really feels like you are inside the Pokemon game. And a lot of the puzzles are so clever. And when you find the Pokemon, it is a real sense of accomplishment. And after everything is finished, they give you a list of all the Pokemon. And I was amazed that all the Pokemon I didn't find. I found, I don't remember the exact number, but I found like a little under half. So which means, well, I got to go back another time and find find them again. And there are multiple routes. I went on the forest route, but there's also like a mountain route. So they definitely are encouraging people to come back more than once. So I thought, well, this is something that is really only in Japan, because it utilizes Japanese nature. It utilizes, of course, this iconic Japanese franchise Pokemon. It puts them together. So this is a really amazing experience. And I think if Pokemon fans experienced it, like from overseas, I think they would probably freak out, because it is really amazing. I really can't undersell how great this experience is. It's definitely my favorite kind of gaming related thing I've done in Tokyo.
And you're a big Pokemon fan, right? I've heard you talk about it a lot on the podcast.
Yes, I'm a huge Pokemon nerd. So sometimes I kind of worry, am I talking about Pokemon too much on this podcast? But yeah, it's my podcast, so I can talk about whatever I want. And if you're a Pokemon fan, Tokyo is definitely catering to you. So there's a lot to do.
Well, that just means that I'm going to have you back on the show for a Pokemon episode, because I have not done one yet. And one of the things that have held me up from it is like, I try to find a guest who is either A, knowledgeable, or B, passionate, or the ideal being both. And you appear to check off both those boxes. Cause like I like Pokemon well enough, but I am one of those people who played Gen 1 Red and Blue and didn't touch it again until X and Y on the 3DS in like 2011. Mm-hmm. Didn't play any of them. So like outside of the original 150, I know maybe an extra 10, if that. It's bad. It's real. And even now, I don't even remember all the original 150 because it's been so long.
Right.
I have been thinking, though, of doing, so I stream occasionally. I never shouted on the podcast. By the way, listeners, twitch.tv/stillloadingpod if you want to watch me. At the time of this recording, I don't know what I'll be playing when this comes out, but I'm working my way through Ni No Kuni on Tuesday nights and Dark Souls on Saturday nights. So you can see me look at adorable Ghibli art, or you can see me get incredibly angry on Saturday. So your choice. So maybe I'll switch over to Pokemon, because I've only ever played, like I said, original Red and Blue, and I've played Gold and Silver, but I've never beaten it. I've gotten maybe only a handful of hours in, and I'll save my stories for when I do the episode, because I have some funny stories about why I never like continued on with Pokemon. And let me tell you, the reasons are not good. They're dumb. They're just really dumb. But anyway, that's good to know. I might have to, if you'd be willing, I'd love to have you back on for that.
Definitely.
So, now you mentioned that, I think you mentioned off mic that you've mentioned on your podcast your wife has gone to a number of these with you. How often does she come with you to these? Is this like something that you and her do a lot, or are you going to a lot of these events solo?
I think it is a good mix. Sometimes a lot of the times I'm sort of dragging my wife to these events. I'll say, oh, honey, I've got a great date idea for this weekend. And she's like, oh, what? I'm like, okay, here's this very nerdy thing that you have limited interest in.
It's about Pokemon, but hear me out.
She actually comes to quite a bit. Yeah, she did come with me during the Pokemon Wonder event. So
I feel like that would be a good one for a date, because it's hiking, and hiking's a fun date.
Yeah, and you really need more than one person for that. I would say, I think I say on my podcast, maybe like three or four would be good. Cause somebody needs to hold like the map for the clues and things like that. And somebody needs to be actively searching. So yeah, she does come on quite a bit with me. Like she came, of course, I had her on my podcast for the Street Fighter exhibit. Mm-hmm. Cause she is not really a gamer. She's like a lapsed gamer. She had a Super Famicom and PlayStation as a kid. And she plays like kind of like the famous, like Japanese iconic games like Dragon Quest, and like she played like Earthbound or Mother 2. Mm-hmm. And then she really didn't play a game for like years and years, but then she somehow got hold of like a PS4, and she got interested in the Ryuga Gotoku series, which is Yakuza in English.
Okay.
So she has played all the Yakuza games somehow, even though she didn't game really for like 20 years.
She that just is like a heavy thing to get into. I mean, I've never played a Yakuza game, but like that's like a 0 to 100 to dive back into the gaming.
Yeah. So it's very, yes, I'm not quite sure like how she managed to like complete all of them, but she did it. And that's like the only series she's really interested in. Like she, like me, of course, I'm looking like every week. It's like, okay, what's the new game release? But for her, she beat Lost Judgment last year. And then she's like, well, I'll just wait till the next Yakuza or Judgment game comes out. And then she can like kind of like a gaming camel, just consume all that gaming content and then just rest until the end.
And it'll last her for years.
Yes.
Or for however long that is. That's funny. That's interesting. It's like this. I don't know why this got made me think of it. It's not gaming related, but like just talking about something where it's like, My wife is similar to like you and your wife are similar to how my wife and I are, where she's not into games at all. The difference is that your wife has kind of gotten back into games to a certain extent, only, you know, like you said, a select few. Mine still is not really interested in them. Though I actually want to have, I had her on to do an episode on Stardew Valley a couple of years ago now. But I want to have her back on because she only really played like the Mary-Kate and Ashley games as a kid. And
oh, well,
it'd be kind of interesting as someone who would have had zero interest in doing them just to do an episode on the Mary-Kate and Ashley games. So teaser for all you listeners, that might be coming out sometime, not soon, but sometime. But there is a time when we're not really big into horror stuff, like horror movies. But I told her, I'm like, well, I could get into it if like, you know, it has a good story. Like the original Saw movie actually has a decent story. It's still like really blood, like gory and violent and kind of uncomfortable, but it's got a pretty decent story. And she's like, nah, I don't think I could ever watch it. And it was before we were even engaged. I come over to her house and she's watching like Saw 5. And I go, what happened? And she goes, I saw the first one. Now I have to watch all of them. Like, what is going on here? Like, what did you do with my wife? Just 0 to 100. I know that's kind of a tangential connection. My mind works in weird ways like that. But okay, so we've talked about your podcast for a little bit now. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about you. I want my listeners to get to know you a little bit more. What types of games are you into, and what got you into video games in the first place?
Well, I got into video games as a very young child. I think the first time I played a game, I was 4 years old. And that was, of course, Super Mario Brothers, the original one for the NES. And since I got, and after that, I got an NES for my 5th birthday. I vividly remember this. And since then, it's pretty much just been, you know, gaming until the day I die, I suppose. So I kind of did grow up, yeah, a Nintendo fan. That was the console I had first, and then every iteration since then, I followed Nintendo. But I of course I like other non-Nintendo games as well. Like I did have a Genesis, and of course I had like several different PlayStations. I'm one of the elite few in Japan that actually owns a PlayStation 5, so I consider myself very lucky on that end. But for me, if you ask me what is your favorite company, I would definitely say Nintendo. And, you know, if I only had one gaming console, I would definitely pick a Nintendo console, because I have a lot of emotional investment into these Nintendo franchises. And to me, I feel like they are the most, I don't want to say innovative, but they go their own path. And so what they do is not going to be what everyone else is going to do. And it might not be the right path, and it might not be the logical path, but it will be a truly unique one. And they offer experiences that really only Nintendo offers. So I typically try to float, you know, of course, I'm a huge fan of the Nintendo first party games. And I'm a big fan of other Japanese games. Of course, I really love JRPGs. And I really love a lot of the traditional Japanese franchises as well. I do enjoy Western games too. I sometimes feature them on my podcast every now and then. But yeah, most of the time I stick with Japanese games.
That I would love to get your opinion on this then. I listened to a podcast called Retronauts, and they've made this point about Nintendo before, and I kind of agree with it. They were saying how, you know, Nintendo, I mean, as I know you're big into, from what I can tell, you like Japanese history and video game history. So you know that Nintendo was a toy company and originally a playing card company before that. And I think they made a really good observation that Nintendo never really lost that toy company mindset. Like it's, or not completely. It's still, you know, they're obviously a video game company now, but it feels like a lot of their ideas really, they still try to have that toy mindset. I mean, even if you look back at the Amiibos, it was kind of, you know, action figures sort of, or like figurines. If you look at the, I don't know how well it did. I'm assuming it didn't do well in the US. I don't know how well it did outside of the US or in different countries, but the Labo.
Yes.
And super original and unique idea. It didn't do great, but it was super cool. I never understood the backlash to Labo. I'm going to die on this hill. I don't understand why people hated it so much. I understand why it wasn't their cup of tea, but like people are always like, you're selling us cardboard. I'm like, it's cardboard that interacts with a video game console. I don't know what this is. Witchcraft. What's wrong with you? So like, what do you think of that though? Do you agree with that observation that Nintendo never really lost their toy mentality completely?
I definitely agree with that. Especially because for Nintendo, a lot of their uniqueness comes from their hardware. And if you think about it, toys are really just hardware, right? It's something tactile that you use. Of course, Nintendo are the masters, of course, to me, they're the masters of software development, of game design. But their hardware is really their key defining point a lot of the time, or their key marketing point. Of course, the Switch is successful, of course, not only because of the amazing software that, of course, helps a lot, but also because they offered people a unique way to play games, and they offered people a lot of freedom in playing games. And even if you go back all the way, even back to the NES or SNES days, that controller was very different. The SNES controller, the NES controller was very different from what Atari was offering or what a lot of other older game hardware manufacturers were offering. So, and then, yeah, of course, like the N64 and the GameCube, the Wii. Wii, of course, maybe one of the more iconic examples of Nintendo going a completely different path and offering gamers a completely new experience in order to, you know, give people something that they haven't experienced before. So even though a lot of the people at Nintendo, of course, they weren't working with Nintendo when they were solely a toy company, but they still have kind of that idea of like innovation and, you know, fun. And if you look at a lot of their toys when they were a toy company, they were quite innovative. They, of course, the most famous being the Ultra Hand, which seems like quite silly now, but nobody else was, you know, making this. And Nintendo was also the first company to introduce like the 52 deck playing cards to Japan. So even though this is, you know, not something they created, they still were able to see the audience for it and try to make their own spin on it. And one of the ways they did that was because they did a licensing deal with Disney to bring like their iconic Disney characters to playing cards. So that was kind of like the first big Nintendo breakout hit. Was these actually Disney 52 deck playing cards, which is kind of funny because people say, oh, Nintendo is kind of the Disney of video games, but they've had like quite a long connection. So
yeah, I didn't actually know the Disney connection to that. I feel like I might have at one point in time in college, I did an essay or like a presentation on the history of Nintendo, but I forget. It's been so long since, I mean, college is a while ago for me now. But that's I agree with you. And I also think it's Nintendo specifically, like they are so not afraid to try something different. Like what you were saying about how you can't describe Nintendo in any other way but Nintendo.
Right.
You know, like they've kind of cornered the market on whatever it is that they do. You can't really pinpoint what they are anymore. And I mean, obviously they're a video game company, but like how they design games and hardware is so unique and so different. And I'm not even saying that because I'm like a Nintendo fanboy. I typically, for like the last two console generations, I was a Sony fanboy. Still am to a smaller degree. I don't have a PS5, but a lot of that's because, you know, I need to spend my money in more important things like being a parent and stuff like that. But like, even look back, like, their flops, like the GameCube was their most tame console by comparison. You know, like they went for more power and everything. The controller was goofy, but they went for the most power in there. But even with that, they tried so many different things. You know, like the GBA connector, the GBA like expansion to play GBA games on your GameCube. You could also go online with it, which, well, that wasn't too uncommon because you had others. It wasn't easy, but you could do it. There are so many unique things, even with the GameCube, that you could do. That's just like fascinating to me. Nintendo, I think I love what they're doing, and I hope they're around for a long, long time, because no other game company really quite does what they do.
Right.
So to kind of pivot away from this, what are some suggestions you would have for gamers visiting Japan? Like, where are places that people should go? There's I don't know a lot of different destinations personally. The only place that I'd know I would go to would be the most well-known retro game store, Super Potato. But that's about it. Where would you suggest gamers visit?
Well, first, if you are a gamer visiting Tokyo, this is kind of the antithesis of my podcast, but I would recommend don't just do gaming things. I would dedicate maybe like a day or two to like really just nerd out and spend the rest of the day is kind of exploring the other parts of Tokyo or Japan, because Japan does have, you know, quite a lot to offer. You know, spend some time in like a matcha cafe, or spend some time, you know, walking down like a quiet neighborhood, or there's a big arts community. So I would say, you know, don't just spend all your time, you know, like sitting in like dusty, like retro game aisles, but definitely spend maybe like a day or two doing just that. Spend some time nerding out, but don't spend all your time. But in your designated like nerd out period, there is like quite a lot to do in Tokyo. And it really depends on your gaming interest. Like, I would say if you're a Nintendo fan, of course, Tokyo is really, you know, quite amazing. Nintendo, I don't want to say runs gaming in Japan, but right now it is really kind of like the peak like domination point of Nintendo in Japan right now. A lot of their games are, you know, if you look at these Japanese hardware software sales, almost all of them are the Switch, and they are taking up a lot of store space, and Nintendo is being really aggressive in terms of reaching people who normally don't play games by hosting exhibits, by doing a lot of interesting collaborations. So like, if you're an Xbox fan, you might be a little bummed if you come to Tokyo, but there are some interesting Xbox, you know, elements and things that you can discover. Some of my recommendations, if you do come to Tokyo, I think definitely one thing you should take advantage of is the arcades, because there are a lot of chain arcades here, like Taito and what I mentioned before, Gigo, formerly Sega. Even though a lot of these are kind of similar in what they have, they are still pretty impressive, especially compared to maybe a lot of other countries. And there are plenty of retro arcades. Like I mentioned before, the Mikado Game Center in Takada no Baba is definitely worth visiting. And in terms of shopping, definitely a lot. If you're a Nintendo fan, Nintendo Tokyo has pretty much become a must-visit place. And not just Nintendo Tokyo, but the building it's located in is called Parco Shibuya. Parco is kind of like a chain department store. They have many huge department stores throughout Japan. And in 2020 or late 2019, they opened up Parco Shibuya. And again, this is another thing I mentioned on the podcast. Floor 6 is called Cyber Shibuya. And it is basically dedicated to just like otaku and dedicated to game nerds.
Okay.
Because on this floor, they have Nintendo Tokyo, which is a massive Nintendo merchandise store. They have Pokemon Center Shibuya, which is, of course, a Pokemon merchandise store. And they have some exclusive merch, and it has a really awesome layout. It looks like you're on a spaceship, and it's very hip and modern. And they also have the Capcom stores there, and also the Shonen Jump, which is like the famous like Japanese comic brand. And they have like some pop-up store cafes. There's an esports cafe there. So just that floor alone, and you could spend quite a lot of time there. And I would also recommend looking up your favorite franchise and seeing if there's maybe some exhibit that is being hosted. Like the Street Fighter exhibit came kind of out of nowhere. And there's often like Pokemon and Kirby exhibits, and even like a lot of smaller stuff. Like one of the cafes called Tokyo Video Gamers in Akiba, they had a collaboration with Grandia, which is kind of a bit of an obscure JRPG series. But if you're a big Grandia fan, you could have gone there and like had sort of like Grandia themed like food and Grandia merchandise. So even that kind of obscure like franchise,
that's kind of awesome. You know,
has its day in the sun in Japan,
yeah,
in Tokyo.
Now, you were saying before, like, you know, don't just do only nerdy and geeky things and gamer things. Where are some places you would recommend people to go outside of that realm, outside of that sphere? Like you meant that Pokemon, Wonder, I think, right? Pokemon, yes. Wonder. Oh God, thank God, yes, I remember Pokemon that. Wonder. My memory is so bad on the short term. That sounded really interesting, but not just because it was Pokemon, but because you kind of got to explore and hiking. Like personally, I really like out like going hiking into like the woods and stuff like that. Where are some places, whether it's like that or just any other suggestions you have?
I would definitely recommend, because I have a sweet tooth. So I really love Japanese sweets. So Japan has, I think it's not so common in the West. Maybe people know about it. But a lot of traditional Japanese sweets are, you know, really amazing and really not available elsewhere. And there are many sweets cafes that you can visit in Japan that are focused only on like traditional Japanese sweets, like a manju or a wagashi. Wagashi is like the name for traditional Japanese sweets. Mm-hmm. And there's a ton of cafes. I kind of wish I could remember like one specific. Maybe Tsurunobu Yoshinoya. What's it called? I can't now. It's on the tip of my tongue. Is it Tsuruya Yoshinobu? This is one of my most recommended places to visit in Tokyo. It is a traditional Japanese wagashi place. And what's really cool is that if you sit at the counter, they make the sweets in front of you.
Really?
Yes. So it's really impressive. And the tools they use are really unorthodox, not something you've probably seen before. A lot of wooden tools, and not only is it delicious, but the wagashi almost looks like art. So I really highly recommend this place. And of course, in Tokyo, I would also say indulge in your hobby. Like if you are a big like wrestling fan, definitely check out like the wrestling area of Tokyo. If you really love fishing, check out the fishing equipment stores or go fishing near Tokyo. There are many tours that do that. Or if you're into hiking, of course, there's a lot of different places to hike, not really in Tokyo proper, but in the surrounding area, like Okutama.
Yeah.
So I would recommend whatever you like to do, don't just follow, you know, the guide like, oh, Tokyo day one, go to Ginza, Tokyo day two, go to Shinjuku. Think about what you really like to do. Think about what you really want to do, and you can experience it in Tokyo. And especially a lot of DIY stuff. So if you really like DIY, Tokyo is definitely the number one place for that. But definitely, yeah, spend a day or two, yeah, hanging out at retro game stores, hanging out in arcades, but don't make it your whole trip. Try to get everything out maybe in 1 or 2 days, because there's a lot to see in Tokyo.
I have always wanted to go to Japan, to Tokyo, just anywhere, but even since like before I started the podcast, before I really got into video game history and all that, I just really always wanted to go to Japan. And I just eventually I'll make it. Someday I will make it over there. I am nervous about the time difference, though, getting to adjust that. Do you remember what it was like having to adjust to that time zone difference when you first moved?
Yeah, it definitely.
I know it's a very odd question, but
it definitely takes it depends on each person. For me, it almost takes like a week for me to feel like 100% again. Recently, I did take an international trip, and even though it wasn't a big time difference, as say like from New York to Tokyo, it was still like quite a few hours. So it takes some adjustment. It takes like some unorthodox naps that you need to take before your clock gets back on schedule. But yeah, it takes, it's different for everybody. Some people, like after one day, they're fine. For me, I'm okay after maybe 1 or 2 days, but I won't feel 100% until maybe a week later.
I can only imagine. It's actually funny. So my first, time I ever saw any like Japan, not in, like I said, never in person, but like in like a movie or something. Have you ever heard of the movie series Three Ninjas?
Yes. Yes, of course.
They're not great. I love them. I love them to pieces. I have an unironic love for them because I grew up, it's nostalgia goggles have clouded my vision. But in the second movie, Three Ninjas Kick Back, they visit Japan. And I really loved seeing everything in there. I don't know how culturally sensitive that movie is. I am not the one to decide that. But it's definitely at least very, it was definitely like super interesting to me as a kid to watch it. I'm like, oh, Japan just seems so interesting. So I'll make it out there eventually. So I don't really have too much else. I should have written down more questions because I don't want this episode to end. I'm really enjoying this. Let's talk a little bit about your podcast and then we can do a little bit of a sign off. So, or a little bit more about your podcast, excuse me. We can do a sign off. So out of the topics you've covered so far on your show, what has been your favorite topics or what maybe even less specific, what's been your favorite episode so far?
My favorite episode, anytime I have a guest on, that automatically kind of jumps up to the top. A lot of the podcast, of course, is a solo podcast. So a lot of it is me talking. And sometimes I wonder, are people okay just listening to me? So I like to mix it up a bit. So I like to have as many guests on as, you know, as many as possible. So some of my past guests, of course, my wife, of course, the greatest guest there ever was and ever will be.
Good brownie so points she, earning right yes. there.
So she has a kind of a fun, perspective because she is a lapsed gamer, but she did play, of course, she played Street Fighter II like everyone else did as a child. And we did play some Street Fighter together. And I noticed she was quite good, even though she hadn't played in quite a long time. So just to hear that kind of perspective about, okay, why did you like Street Fighter, even though you're not really a big gamer? And what did you think about, you know, seeing all this art? Because she's also very knowledgeable about that aspect as well. So hearing that kind of perspective is pretty interesting. Some other great guests I've had recently, I had the Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd on, and he talked about visiting the Tokyo Game Music Show, which is a comic market, like a comic market where you can visit different booths. And at these booths are Japanese composers. And some of them are a bit more obscure, but some of them have quite a lot of credits to their name, especially working on older arcade titles. So it's very interesting to hear his perspective on why he likes Japanese game music and also about these Japanese game musicians that maybe are not household names, but they've contributed a lot to the medium and they're still actively working and kind of their history with the changing medium. And also one of the more fun parts of that conversation was talking about like Japanese game developer house bands. A lot of old Japanese game companies used to have like an in-house band.
Yeah.
The composer used to run. Like, I think one of the more famous ones is like Alf Lila, which is what was Capcom's band.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting that it's not just one company, but a lot of these, especially older arcade focused companies, had like an in-house band to kind of compose music and also like pump out CDs and whatnot. So that's kind of a fun talking point. Another great guest I had was Alex Krauss, who is an official Hard Off ambassador. Hard Off is a used goods shop in Japan, and they sell everything relating to, you know, air conditioners, laptops, old guitars, but they have quite a notable game section. And you can get a lot of retro games very, very, very cheap. I'm talking maybe 100 yen, which is like $1.
Oh, God, and, I wish.
And he is... And he's an expert on all things Hard Off. He's a great follower on Twitter because he often visits a lot of these recycle shops. And you really never know what you're going to find when you go in there, which is part of the fun. You don't know. Maybe they have you know, a box copy of Chrono Trigger for, you know, $10. Maybe they have some sort of never been sold before, like a display promo for the Sega Dreamcast. You never know what's inside until you actually visit. So it's kind of like almost like a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
Another great guest I had on was Gracion, who is a fellow Pokemon fan who lives in Tokyo, and she is a Pokemon card expert. And okay. So she kind of gave some perspective about shopping for Pokemon cards in Tokyo. Like I mentioned before, if you have a hobby, there's a place in Tokyo for that. And if you're really into trading card games, you know, Tokyo has stores solely dedicated to trading card games, which is something I think not a lot of other places have. And there's even stores solely dedicated to the Pokemon trading card game.
Wow.
Recently opened up in Akihabara, I guess last year. It's like a 6-floor store called Hareruya 2, which is only Pokemon cards. So it's hard to imagine like a 6-story place that's only selling Pokemon cards, but it exists in Tokyo, which is
nuts.
One of the things I love about Tokyo is that if you can imagine it, it's probably here somewhere. And one thing I really want to focus on in the future, I want to definitely get more like Japanese people on as guests. But of course, there is a language barrier. And sometimes some people are maybe a bit shy of coming on to the podcast, especially speaking English, which is, you know, their second language. I want to get like a bilingual Japanese English like Twitch streamer on. And I've contacted a few, but they've kind of given me the cold shoulder, maybe for good reason. I don't blame them, but maybe they're a bit shy or they've never been on a podcast. But I definitely want to get more Japanese people on my podcast to kind of hear their perspective on gaming. Because even though we have translations of like Japanese articles, we really don't often hear a lot of perspectives from Japanese people regarding games, about their fandom, about their interest in English. If you want to read, of course, you know, they're often on, a lot of Japanese gamers are centralized on Twitter. So you can follow a lot of people who, you know, are raving about, you know, a lot of Japanese like Kirby fans, for example, showing off their Kirby collections, or a lot of Japanese retro game hunters showing off what they found. These people exist on Twitter, but nobody is really giving them a platform, or nobody is really asking them a lot of questions about their specific fandom. So that's something I kind of want to break that barrier. Of course, I could interview them in Japanese, but it's, you know, it's hard to, how do I translate it? Do I upload it to YouTube with subtitles, or do I dub over them? I'm still trying to figure out like the best method for that.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping is there somebody who is really bilingual who wants to come on the podcast, who is willing to share these experiences? I'm still searching for them. But even, you know, people who are living in Japan who have some sort of fun perspective about their hobby, about gaming, about also what I do, which is, you know, living life as a gamer in Japan. The name of my podcast is Tokyo Game Life. So what are the three things I really do in Japan? Well, I live in Tokyo, I game, and then I live. I visit these places. I go out and like experience new things. So in the future, I definitely want a lot more guests, a lot of people who are passionate about maybe something. I kind of want to focus a lot more on sort of like the fandom aspect. In the future, I definitely am interested in getting like developers on as well. But I really like the kind of fandom aspect about why do you like games? Why are you passionate about games? Or what is something that is very specific that you are really interested in, whether it's game music or retro games or Pokemon cards? I really like to hear that perspective and give people a platform for that. So I'm hoping my podcast kind of becomes a place where people who live in Japan or people who just like Japanese games can come and listen and also maybe share their experiences. And I really try to make it a very positive atmosphere about, you know, sharing about why I like games. A lot of gaming podcasts, sometimes they can be, you know, quite critical, oftentimes for good reason. But I really want to focus on, you know, sharing my passion and sharing why I like games.
I like that. I really like that. That resonates with me a lot. Not because I'm Japanese, obviously, I'm far from it. Sometimes I wish, but it that reminds me, there's a friend of mine named Cade. He is the host of a podcast called Gaming Memories. And the whole premise of it is just he interviews people he finds interesting, usually musicians, podcasters, collectors, Instagram influencers or stuff like that, and just asking them about their specific gaming memories. He always likes to make a game of it. Like, what was their, he tries to guess their first ever console based off of how old they are, or based off some of the hints that he gets, that kind of thing. And I like that your show isn't strictly like what you're just saying. It doesn't seem strictly just that, but it's like you're saying, there's not really a whole lot of, there's not a platform for Japanese gamers like that, at least not out here on that I see online. And I'm only speaking from an American perspective. So who knows, you know, like it, I mean, in fact, you're saying it though, and you live over in Japan, I guess it is kind of true. There's not a platform to really hear a different perspective like that. So I would love if you're able to start doing this, and I like the vision of it. I think that you will hit that vision. You will get to there. And I'm excited to hear what it is when you get to it. Cause I really like that idea, like a lot. I think one of the most underrated things in, when you hear other people talk, it's like people like to talk about themselves, but two, also nostalgia is addictive. Like I can't speak for everyone else, but I love hearing about other people's nostalgia. Like it, and I don't mean necessarily like, oh, I used to play this game as a kid and I really enjoyed it. I mean, that's still nice to hear, but when people tell specific stories of, you know, like we were talking a bit, I think we were talking about this off mic. I don't remember if we said it on mic, but that you kind of like look at your life, you kind of recall your life through console generations. Like, this is what was happening during the PS1 era. This is what was happening during the GameCube era. And it's memories like that where it's something bizarrely specific. And, you know, people don't have to get too personal, but they can still tell stories of like I was actually on a podcast recently. I talked about how for me, like, college very much reminds me of Minecraft and PS3 specifically. Like, I didn't play Minecraft on PS3, but I had a roommate who, I was still living with my parents, and my roommate, it was a friend of mine, needed a place to stay, and he lived with us for like over a year or so. And I'm amazed I didn't get extremely overweight, because what we would do is we would order Pizza Hut stuffed crust Pizza Hut pizza, play Minecraft, and drink nothing but Mountain Dew until like 4 a.m. while watching Scrubs on like repeat. It was a wonderful, magical time. And those types of memories are super fun to listen to. So I'd be very curious what it would be like for people over in Japan. I think this will work really well. I'm excited to hear your show evolve as it goes along. So, let's start wrapping this up. Where can everybody find you online? And is there anything, obviously you want to promote your podcast, but well, this will be out in a couple of weeks, but is there anything you'd like to promote? Is there anything besides the podcast? Shout out all your stuff.
Yes. So of course I'm the host of Tokyo Game Life, which is available on all podcast apps. So if you are a podcast listener, go ahead and search Tokyo Game Life. And I am on pretty much every social media channel, Twitter at Tokyo Game Life, Instagram also at Tokyo Game Life. I have a TikTok and YouTube. I don't really use that much, but I do upload the podcast to YouTube, but it's audio only for now. But in the future, I'm interested in doing maybe a bit more YouTube content. But right now I'm trying to focus mostly on my podcast. So yes, Tokyo Game Life, just search that in whatever social media platform you use or whatever podcast app you use. And I'm there talking about, you know, video games, mostly Nintendo, but sometimes other stuff as well. Japanese games, also interesting places to visit in Japan regarding gaming. Also, you know, kind of interesting cultural elements. Like I talked about Nintendo Dream, which is sort of Japan's answer to Nintendo Power. And really it's a great place to hear more about the perspective of somebody who lives in Japan. And I have a ton of great guests. So it's definitely a must listen podcast, if I do say so myself.
I would be inclined to agree, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. This has been amazing, man. Thank you so much for coming on. So like he said, go check out all of his stuff, Tokyo Game Life everywhere. As for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. Probably the easiest and most importantly, free for all of you. Just give it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. Not only does that make me feel warm and fuzzy, it also helps more people find the show. If you do want to support it monetarily, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For $1 a month, you'll get the episodes a few days early at a higher bitrate and access to a patron exclusive Discord. For $5 a month, you'll get all of that plus 2 extra bonus episodes a month. At the time of this recording, actually the day of this recording, I just released a bonus episode called Genesis Jams Volume 1, where I picked 5 different songs from Sega Genesis games that I really liked. I technically should have probably called it the Mega Drive because that's where it's better known outside of North America, but that's not as alliterative as Genesis Jams is, so we're going with Genesis Jams. Anyway, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But the most important shout out I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to go support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Mono, thank you once again so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And I will see you all next time.